supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Today's show is about the teenage brain. Some people consider it like dark matter. You know it's there, but it's just impossible to understand. But joking aside, these can be years of great excitement as we watch our children become young adults and begin to think about their futures, their identities. And these can be years of great turmoil. The developing brain is not yet able to weigh the risks and benefits of their choices or to understand the long-term consequences of short-term behavior. Our guest today is just the right guy to help us shed some light on this dark matter of the teenage brain. Dr. Dan Siegel is a professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine and internationally renowned for his book, MindSight. His newest book is Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. It offers us new insights into the field of adolescent psychology and some of the myths we've gotten wrong over the past few decades. Dan joins us by phone from New York, where he's currently attending a conference. Hey, Dan, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thanks, Dan. It's a pleasure for me to be here with you and all your listeners.
Thanks. Well, if you've got a teenager or about to have a teenager or had a teenager and you'd like to get some information, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, you know, Dan, I just mixed up words. I went from adolescent to teenager. Are they the same?
Well, that's a great place to start, Dan. You know, the teenage years, of course, are marked by the number that it is. 13 is the beginning of the teenage years, and 19 is the end. But the term adolescence really means the period between childhood and adulthood. So it's really between childhood dependency and adult responsibility. And we're studying now so much about the adolescent brain that we understand that it's not the same, as you're pointing out, as teenage years. So the adolescent brain begins to change even before 13, sometimes around 12 or 11, even younger sometimes, and it continues to change well into the mid-20s, which was a shock to everyone. So this is really the second dozen years of life, is a better way to think of it, than the teenage years. But we use the word teenage a lot, and so it's a common phrase to just say the teenage brain or what's going on in your teenager. But this adolescent period is actually much longer than just the teenage years.
I also wonder, you say mid-20s, and now I look at the larger culture and what's happening in today's economy. So kids are coming home and staying home sometimes till their mid, late 20s, early 30s.
Absolutely.
Does that have any impact on the brain and vice versa?
Absolutely. One of the centers that I help run at UCLA is a center that looks at how culture, that is how we interact with each other in society, in schools, and even in families, how all those interactions we have actually influence the way the brain develops. And the overall conclusion from those studies is basically this: culture does shape the actual structure as well as function of the brain. And so the studies I'm referring to do refer to mostly American kids in this society that we're in. If we went to a different society where at 18 or 19 you started assuming adult responsibilities, we might find, those studies have never been done, but theoretically we could find the brain kind of completes its remodeling around that time. But in the U.S., we really have this finding that the remodeling goes on well into the 20s. And as you're pointing out, if kids are not taking on responsibilities, perhaps we'll find that, you know, in their 30s, they're still having these remodeling changes. We don't know. That's a study that should be done, but it's a really interesting question.
Hey, Dan, you know, we spoke last week, and I asked you What's the most important thing you want to get out? And you said that you wanted to make sure we talked about some of the false beliefs about adolescence. So what are some of those false beliefs, and shed some light on it for us?
Yeah, and you know, this is so important because, as we spoke about last week, and for all of us to think about, you know, we have beliefs that we're taught, you know, in our families, in our schools, in our communities, in the larger media through radio and television and now social media. We get messages, and these messages shape how we believe things are, and in turn, those beliefs shape how we behave toward others, and our behavior can actually shape how other people behave. So the importance of going through these myths that you and I are about to talk about is that if we can really see the truths that are really there and dispel these myths, then there's a lot of fantastic positive things that can happen for an individual, whether it's an adult caring for an adolescent or an adolescent themselves. And the Brainstorm book was written for both the adolescent and adult. It also can change the way we tap into basically the courage and creativity of these this period and these years, where the individual is going through this period, if they're told, and here are the myths, raging hormones are going to drive you mad. And while puberty happens around the time of onset of adolescence, that sexual maturation and hormones rise, it's not raging hormones that change things. We now believe it's changes in the way the brain is remodeling. It's actually pruning away certain circuits, and it's actually strengthening the remaining circuits. That's called myelination.
Let me stop you there.
Yeah.
Explain.
Yeah, pruning. So, well, the brain is basically composed of lots of single cells called neurons that communicate with each other, and there are a lot of them. And the way they connect with each other determines how things like the way you feel unfolds, or how you focus attention, or what has meaning for you, or even how you relate to other people. So we're interested in the connections in the brain because they influence our mental experience, how we feel about being alive, whether we're depressed or feeling elated, or whether we're feeling this sense of connection to others or we're isolated.
So tell
us, mental experience is shaped in part by the connections in the brain.
So what's going on during puberty and these hormones we've been talking about? So what goes quiet and what gets activated?
Well, thing is, it's not the hormones of puberty change a number of functions in the brain, it's true, but the bigger issue that we're discovering that we didn't know about 15 years ago at all was that there is a remodeling going on in the brain. It's not just hormones. This is the myth, that it's actually the way the brain is genetically designed to start specializing, to start losing the circuits it doesn't need anymore that it began to develop in childhood, and then to start strengthening the ones that exist. So ultimately, as you go through these second dozen years of life, your brain is going to be remodeled. The second myth related to that is that people say, well, you know, adolescence, okay, raging hormones, they're going mad, and adolescence is just a period of immaturity that you just need to get through if you're lucky. And that attitude really dismisses the incredible essence of adolescence. They're positive features that if we recognize them, and I talk about them a lot in the book step by step, but if you recognize them, you can actually optimize the upsides of them and minimize the downsides, like the risk and the way that, in fact, emotions can take over and all sorts of things that we can explore if you'd like. But the point is of this myth is that people say, oh, the adolescent period, you're just immature, and that's just not true. An adolescent as immature, they can act that way. But if you realize it's a time of transformation that's about remodeling, not immaturity where you're just waiting to become an adult, we can really optimize this period of time.
Let me reintroduce you, and then I want to take a half step away from the brain and talk about the nature of adolescence in general and these days in particular. We're talking with psychiatrist Dr. Dan Siegel, who's written Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. If you've got a teenager, if you've got questions about your teenager or you're about to have a teenager and you've got some concerns, give us a call. We're at 888-477-4373. 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, Dan, let's talk about the nature of adolescence. As you said, it's a time of great transition for young people. It's a time when they re-examine their relationship with their family, their peers, the larger community. So tell us what's going on psychologically, socially.
Yeah, with teenagers. Absolutely. Well, there's a phrase called essence that helps us remember what the four essential features of adolescence really are. And here they are. I'll name them and we can talk about them. Each one has an upside and each one has a downside. And I think the key is to acknowledge what the essence of adolescence is instead of being misled by the myths, and then to do what you can as an adult caring for an adolescent, whether you're a parent or teacher or therapist or coach or mentor, or if you're the adolescent, him or herself, you actually can take this knowledge and change the way you approach your life. So essence is an acronym, and so the first part of the acronym, ES, is emotional spark. The adolescent life is filled with the influence of emotions, much more on reasoning than earlier in life and even then in later in life. Then the SE is social engagement. The adolescents are really moving away from parents, not totally away from them, but pushing away from parents. That's a natural process, and moving toward peers. And that's very healthy as a part of the movement to getting ready to leave home.
Well, that's easy for you to say. It depends on which peers they move towards.
Well, that's the downside. So the downside of social engagement, this SE part of essence, is just what you're saying. The need to be a member of a social group of peers, if the peers are having a lot of negative values and negative behaviors, can make you give up your own values for membership. And that, as you're saying, can be a real downside. The upside is you can get adolescents in touch with their actual values, developing an internal compass, and they can see the importance of friends, but realize that the importance of living true to their values in an authentic way as possible. And learning social skills is very, very important in life. So this is the upside of the social engagement.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Linda as our first caller. Linda?
Hi,
Linda.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love your show. It's really interesting. I have a quick question. I have a son who just turned 13. He's a child with Asperger's, and I've done a lot of reading with regard to, you know, we know executive functioning, children that are autistic have trouble with that, as well as the social skills aspect. And I was wondering if the doctor has come across any studies with regard to if Asperger teenagers are slightly different than their typical teenagers with regard to, you know, the brain functioning and going through adolescence?
Great question.
Yeah, excellent question. Thank you, Linda. And, you know, adolescence, as we're pointing out, is a time of transformation. And as far as we can tell from studies of individuals with Asperger's, which is, you know, a challenge to not only executive functions, but how you understand your own mind and the internal mental life of others, that it's also a period of great transition. So one of the programs I consult to in Los Angeles has kids along the spectrum, the autism spectrum, which includes Asperger's. And, you know, we see the adolescent period as especially challenging. And so this time is really a time to support them. Of course, there's a difference because the social engagement cannot happen as well, and the emotional intensity can be sometimes harder to deal with. And so we found that giving support groups to kids with Asperger's can be incredibly important.
I hope that was helpful, Linda. I also got involved with autism myself, as you may know, when my grandson Sam was diagnosed at age 18 months on the autism spectrum. And one of the things we discovered, was that brains change around age 5, so we could expect a change in Sam. There might be one, for the better, for the worse. We didn't know. And we could expect another change around the onset of puberty and another around 18 to 20. So I don't know. Now, that wasn't specific, of course. And Dan, I'd like to hear you comment on that. Is the information I got ring true to your research about?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of different studies that support the idea that something in the first 5 years of life is definitely changing in terms of the way an individual with either Asperger's or other variations along the spectrum are wrestling with connecting with other people, understanding other people's intentions, even understanding their own internal state. And so that creates its own challenges in the early years. When you add to that what we're talking about adolescence, then these remodeling changes that are happening make it even more challenging, and the stress that comes up can make it very important, as I was mentioning, to have support for this period even more than before. And so a lot of, there can be an onset of depression, there can be an awareness that I'm different from other kids that when I was younger I may not have had. So that new capacity of adolescence to have a perspective on one's own place with friends and family can actually be really more challenging. And so knowing that and knowing that this is the overlap of adolescence with Asperger's can really give more support.
Linda, I hope that was helpful. Dan, we've got to take a short break here. When we come back, I've got to talk about that which terrifies parents and what's going on and how you can help us be less terrified.
Happy to.
If you can. We're talking with Dr. Dan Siegel. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA. He's on the faculty of the Center for Culture, Brain, and Development, and he's the co-director of the Mindful Awareness Research Institute, a research center, and of course his newest book is called Brainstorm. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you've got an adolescent child from roughly puberty to 25 or so, we'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. Alzheimer's is not curable, but prescription medications can sometimes help to maintain the quality of life for longer periods. Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a research study to test a new investigational medication for patients with a diagnosis of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. 610-277-8073. 610-277-8073 or keystoneclinicalstudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking with Dr. Dan Siegel, neuropsychiatrist, talking about the adolescent brain. Our number is 888-477-9499. Is that accurate label for you, neuropsychiatrist?
Yeah, clinical professor of psychiatry. That's right, at UCLA.
Okay. All right. So, come on. It's time to talk now about what's really scary here. Risk-taking in teenagers. I remember when my daughters were adolescents, my great fear would be that they would do some of the crazy, dangerous stuff that I did. And you know what really aggravates me is they both did. It's just terrible. But your son Benji, jumped off a cliff.
Yeah, my son's friend, yes, Benji, he did. This is the issue, and it completes actually the word essence.
We talked about the emotional spark that drives kids into more emotional ways of being, a social engagement where they're really going to be influenced by peers. And the other two things that also influence the risk-taking behavior are the N of essence is novelty, that there's changes in certain circuits in the brain that involve reward, and these are balanced such a way that there turns out to be a drive to try new things, and especially to drive things that have a kind of exhilarance to them, that you can really be energized, and, you know, risky things have that. The other thing the brain does besides changing this dopamine-based reward system is that it changes the balance of the way the brain evaluates things. So parents have a myth that teenagers or other adolescents just don't know about dangers, but in fact studies suggest they do. And they also have a myth that teenagers' impulsivity, which they definitely have in the beginning of those years, is what leads to this three times increase in risk. But the fact is, it's something else called hyper-rational thinking. And what that is the brain is basically going to focus on the positive, thrilling, exciting parts of a choice and de-emphasize its focus on the downside and the risk.
We tend to focus on that which makes us feel good, which is unfortunately what we do well into adulthood. We tend to address what makes us feel good in the short run. You know, you talked about the younger adolescent brain with your son Benji when he was 13. I read that and I was frankly embarrassed because I did exactly the same thing, only I was 20 and I didn't do as well as Benji. I wound up on crutches for 6 weeks after racking up my knee. So I don't know what that says about me or my brain. But let's go to the phones. We've got Dave on the line. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a 15-year-old son who is very intelligent but makes many, many choices that seem to be contrary to his goals and even his interests. In school, for instance, he's failing a class because he just refuses to turn in homework. No explanation, no reason why. He doesn't get up in the morning, so he misses his bus often. And we're looking for more productive ways of helping to guide or direct him to make wiser choices, knowing that the consequences of some of the choices he's making now are going to have long-term implications.
All right, let me take a wild guess about what's happening between you and your son, that there's a push-pull going on.
Well, there's been that for many, many years, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's, Dan?
Yes.
Yeah. Were you able to hear the beginning of Dave's question?
No. We had a little battery problem. So if you can just summarize for me what Dave is saying, that would be really helpful.
Sure, I would. He's got a 15-year-old son who's making some poor choices that are going to take him away from his life goals. He's not handing homework in. He's coming down late for the bus or missing the bus for school. And it, you know, before this, you know, he's a bright, productive kid.
Mm-hmm.
Fair summary, okay, Dave?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for calling in, Dave. And you know, the challenge of what you're going through, you know, sounds like it's very stressful and can be very upsetting. The perspective, just to begin with, before we address the specifics, is that, you know, adolescence is a period, as we said, where emotions can be high and, you know, you want to hang out with your peers more, you try new things, and even are pushing against what the status quo from adults is. And that's pretty normative. That's the way we expect adolescents to be. But the issue is also that these changes in the adolescent brain, besides the family issues that, Dan, you're mentioning, you know, is it a push-pull that's been going on for years? That attachment issue I talk a lot about in the Brainstorm book. But we need to also realize that sometimes a significant psychiatric disturbance can arise during adolescence. In fact, the major psychiatric disturbances, for example, like depression, are most likely to have their onset during the adolescent period. So we don't want to lose sight, even though I'm, you know, a therapist and I work with families all the time and I really believe in the impact of families on behavior. Sometimes there are other things that go on, like depression, that can get someone to stop participating, to withdraw, to stop doing homework, to stop listening to parents. And that total disengagement would be a concern. So if you've tried various ways to invite him to reflect on what he's doing and that doesn't seem to work, sometimes getting some professional assistance to make sure there's not a depression going on can be really vital, very, very important. Do you find he seems depressed to you?
No, we don't find him to be depressed, and we have been in therapy for the last several years.
Who's we, Dave?
My wife and I and our son. And there is a lot of emotion and stress, but my wife and I have chosen to and learned to disengage from him when he goes into emotional rants and raves, because obviously nothing is accomplished by confronting him during those times. But we just can't seem to put our hands on anything that seems to motivate him to want to make better choices.
Can I want to make a suggestion for you, Dave, and I'm coming at this as a family therapist. And when I heard you describe your son, I had the same question in my mind that Dan did. But you're not going to be able to force him to go see a shrink for an evaluation. That's not going to go well. I would encourage you to engage him in a different way. Take your eye off the goal. Take your eye off the goal of him turning around and becoming the young man he was or becoming the young man you wish him to be. Make the goal understanding the young man he is now. And always approach him with a question, what's it like to be you? Don't try to guide him anywhere or change him into anything else. But what's it like? What's it like inside your mind? What's it like inside your heart? Now, and I encourage all parents, all humans, to approach people with a curious mind and an open heart, because you don't know what it feels like to be him. And your job as a parent is to understand that, not for the purpose of doing anything about it, but for the purpose of getting to know him in a different way, and then maybe you can collaborate. Then maybe, if he feels less alone in the family, then maybe he can open up and share where he suffers and what he struggles with. He'll feel safer if you do that. We all do, Dave. We all feel safer when somebody says, you know, tell me your story. Tell me who you are and what it's like.
Sure.
Okay.
I would totally agree with that. You know, Dave, in the last part of the Brainstorm book are examples of people I work with in therapy that completely support what Dan is saying and take you step by step about how to actually do that with an adolescent in a way where you can be present for them, attuned to what's going on, and really feel what they're going through so they can experience the true trust that arises when you don't have an agenda. You're just really trying to understand them. I couldn't agree more with Dan, and that may be what you're doing already in therapy. So just keep an eye on how that may be going for you and your wife with your son, and see if that helps. The other thing I want to say is that this book, Brainstorm, was written for adolescents to read in a way that if they're motivated to understand themselves, then rather than you telling them about themselves, this gives them the tools, these things called MindSight tools, which can help your son understand what's the origin of his behavior, what's he actually going through, in ways that might be very helpful for him to have that kind of way of just exploring his own inner world.
So I appreciate that.
Yeah, I hope that was helpful, Dave, and I wish you and your son the best. I hope you can start both pulling the oar in the same direction.
Thank you.
Sure. Take care. You know, Dan, we're gonna take another short break. And when we come back, I want to talk about stress and the adolescent brain. And I want to talk about those MindSight tools. I mean, they're just wonderful and clearly spelled out in your book. So we're talking with Dr. Dan Siegel today. He's the author of Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. Our number is 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of lines open, so please call quickly. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'll be back in just 1 minute. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, 50 years after President Johnson declared the war on poverty, how are things going in the poorest state in the nation?
76% of Mississippi's poor children live with a single mom, and those are moms who are working.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking to another Dr. Dan Siegel, author of many books, and his current book is Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. If you've got a teenager, it's really a must read for both of you. Dan, I want to talk about the aforementioned stress, because a lot of the people who are calling in the show are parents who feel stress about their teenagers. And I've got to tell you, every adolescent and every adolescent group I've spoken to in the last two decades have complained about stress. So tell us what stress does to the brain, especially the adolescent brain.
Yeah, absolutely, Dan. Well, first of all, just to support your impressions from what people are saying, the research affirms that adolescents and even young adults past their mid-20s are feeling more stressed today than ever before. Other studies suggest that, you know, how we actually approach the body's stress response, you know, tense muscles and our heart pounding, breathing fast, actually how we interpret that can make a big difference about whether this stress is just an intense lifestyle or a negative effect on our life. So the good news is, by doing what you're doing through radio and through therapy, you know, you can actually, you, Dan, can actually support people understanding what's going on with them and really giving them more resilience. In our larger society, I think there are a huge amount of stressors as people face all the challenges in the world, all the ways in which the climate is changing, unemployment, issues about the big disparity between the wealthy and the poor, things about famine. There's so many things that people are now aware of. And the second layer of that is with the information overload that people are getting, we are now flooded with more data now than in old times people might have received even in an entire lifetime. We can get it in a week of life. So we are flooded, and I call it the infinite. There's an infinite sense of what can happen when you get involved with this flow of information. So what many people are feeling, and certainly the Time magazine this week on the Mindful Revolution and work that Arianna Huffington is doing, work that we do at the Mindful Awareness Research Center at UCLA, we're all really trying to think deeply about what can reduce the stress you're referring to that everyone is feeling. But for adolescents, it's especially crucial because there's stress just innately in this period of life. And our concern is that stress might actually intensify some of that pruning I was talking about. Hmm. So it's especially important to give adolescents the mechanisms. These mindset tools that I talk about in the book that you're referring to are ways of actually reducing stress. So what does that mean? It means that in terms of your brain, you're asking about
you know, it means that you're feeling overwhelmed with your ability to cope, and your body is responding with a rise in blood pressure, a rise in heart rate, muscles are tensing, there's a hormone called cortisol that's secreted, and all of these factors in the short run can be helpful to deal, like if you're crossing the street and a truck is coming at you, all these things could get you across the street faster.
Or if you're participating in the Olympics.
Or if you're participating in the Olympics. Those are all good. That's what's called eustress. That's good. But if they are persistent and they stay elevated, partly because of the conditions in the world and partly actually because of our human brain, we actually begin to worry and have anxiety and are concerned about the future in ways we believe other animals are not. So in certain ways, the human mind, coming in part from our relationships and in part from our brains, you know, is having this vulnerable way that stress can actually perpetuate itself.
Yeah.
So anything we can do to reduce it, like the tools we'll talk about, is really important for everyone to be able to do, including understanding that you can be in charge. You don't have to be passive. You don't have to be a victim. You can actually be the active creator of your own resilience.
Yeah, I want to get to those specifics, but I want to get to the phones. We've got a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. But I do want to challenge something you said, and that is with what is happening in the world, that phrase. And I just would add a caveat. What is happening in the world as told to us by a historical 24-hour news cycle who doesn't get paid by telling us good news, and there is far more good news in the world than there is bad news, and we don't get to hear any of it.
Well, while I agree completely with what you're saying, I do want to support what historians have told me, which is there's also a lot of change in the world, literal change, not just the media's reporting, but the state of the world with changes in everything that I refer to is actually real. It's not just amped up by the media, but certainly we hear about it through the media, and so that is amplifying it. I completely agree.
Well, I want to thank you for that, Dan, and you've just given me a little agita, so I'm going to think twice before I invite you back.
Okay.
Let's
that makes me feel sad.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Lori on the line. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how are you guys?
Okay. What can we do for you?
Any connection to, say, having an overbearing, overprotective parent before your child enters into adolescence? Are you finding that because of that, you know, the adolescent is more difficult? Maybe there's more rebelling. Maybe there's just a more desire for independence, and then they tend to do some things that maybe they wouldn't.
Lori, that's a great question, and it gets back to the push-pull I was talking about earlier. Dan, could you address Lori's question, and then, you know, it brings up the whole issue of attachment that you've spoken to throughout the book, and what role parents play, good news and
absolutely
bad news.
Yeah, thank you, Lori. I mean, the first thing that's the great news is that if you're a parent listening to this and you want to learn about attachment, knowing about where your attachment is, if you're overbearing, for example, or if you're more distant, those may not be ideal, the research suggests, but you can always course correct. It's never too late, ever, to really reflect on your parenting, reflect on how you were parented, reflect on what you've been doing, and reflect on what might be a more helpful way to be. So whatever age your child is, it's always possible to do that. That's the first thing. The research does support what you're saying, which is that if the communication in the relationship before adolescence hits is strong, that kids are able to talk about their feelings, are able to talk about what they're going through, are able to be seen for who they are, just like Dan was describing earlier, that authentic way of being connected to your parent does provide a source of resilience. And kids who don't have that kind of optimal attachment experience, which is about a third of the population, they may be a little more challenged in ways that actually we can support them. So in the Brainstorm book, there's a whole section on attachment for both the adolescent and adult to read, because even if you didn't have that before adolescence begins, it's you can actually work it so that you understand what was the impact of me having an overbearing parent when I was younger. How is that influencing me now as an adolescent? How is it affecting my relationship with my parent now? And these can be all a part of a dialogue. And, you know, what I when I wrote the book, you know, it was really challenging to figure out how to write one conversation for adults and adolescents. But I deeply wanted this, and I've been practicing as a psychiatrist for 30 years and working as a child and adolescent psychiatrist for most of that time. And here's what I found. The more communication and understanding you can get across the generations, the more an adolescent's development in this transformative period can be supported, and the better it is for the parent. So it's a win-win situation. And because adolescence continues on past the teenage years, it becomes really important to recognize this, even after the teenage years have passed, so that you continue to keep these lines of communication open. And you can learn how to do that, too, as a parent, and your adolescent can learn about it as well.
And Dan, you know, from my forthcoming book, I've got a chapter in there about parenting between fear and faith. And, and you know, we have to understand as parents, understand and respect our own anxiety, so that when we feel anxiety, sometimes it carries information, and sometimes sometimes it doesn't. It's just junk from our past or whatever it is. But
absolutely, and it's a beautiful book, Dan. And I, when it comes out, I want to make sure everyone hears that it's available, because it's just fantastic in this very way Dan is talking about. That wisdom can come literally from the inside out. And it's rare these days that people are encouraged to develop these inner sources of wisdom, and yet they're available to us to learn. And we can not only learn them as parents, but actually you can help your adolescent develop an internal compass. So as they face, you know, their emotional spark and the social engagement, this novelty they seek, and also the creative way their mind is exploring the world, that spells the whole word essence, you can actually give them an internal compass so they can reduce their chance of risk. They can actually learn to thrive and not just be overwhelmed and stressed out by these changes. And you as a parent can also get this essence back, because the amazing thing is that this essence, emotional spark, social engagement, novelty, and creative explorations, which is the core of what happens during the adolescent period, is exactly what we need as adults to keep our brains growing and keep them strong throughout the lifespan.
Yeah.
So it's a win-win thing to understand that the essence is something to hold on to and to cultivate well in adolescence, and not just get through adolescence, but actually see these things you can cultivate across your lifespan.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Dolores on the line. Hi, Dolores.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Good. I wanted to ask, when do you know when there is something more going on in adolescence that isn't adolescence? My daughter, who was 18 to 19, was doing a lot of reckless behaviors that she wasn't, and she would say she wouldn't think about the consequences. But then what happened is it came back to us as a family, and specifically for her younger sister, who is going through high school, has really had the fallout from it. Now, we noticed, you know, so the daughter I'm talking about, she's in college now, and I've noticed that she does have more, she is more responsible and seems to be thinking more about the consequences. And when we talk to her about what has happened, she can understand most of it, but she doesn't understand why people's behavior changed toward her because of it. She thought that it was okay when at the time, you know, that it's over and people need to move on.
Well, I this is a really important issue. I'm sure glad that we have Dan Siegel here to address it. So we're on a continuum here, Dan,
Dolores, yeah, it's a really, really important question, I think, that every parent of an adolescent faces. You know, when is behavior you're experiencing with your adolescent part of this essence, you know, when it's part of the transformation that is this brain remodeling, and when has it verged over so that you see it as actually a dysfunctional thing? So to address your specific question about your daughter and your, both your daughters, the first thing to say about risky behaviors is it's in early teenage years, it is this impulsivity where people do things without acting. But in later adolescence, and maybe this is what you're referring to in high school for your daughter, there's a de-emphasis, as I mentioned, on the downside, the consequences, the negative consequences of action, and just a focus on the positive ones. So what I do in these mindset skills, and often schools don't prepare kids in this way, and we don't know how to do this as parents, that's why I put them in the book, is that if you allow your daughter to develop a way literally of getting in touch with what her heart is telling her and what her intestines are telling her, literally we now know in science that the body gives us signals about where our values are rather than just the head making all sorts of hyper-rational thought, like, oh, I'll do this or I'll do that, and who cares? It's the negative side. I don't really care about that, but the upside is I'm doing this kind of behavior.
The body really holds kind of the unedited information, the unedited truth of our lives. You know, that mind of all of ours tells all sorts of stories, but there's no stories in the body. You know, the body holds the simple truth.
And when you get to those simple truths, and maybe she's now getting it as she's in college, you can get an awareness of, wow, okay, now I feel, I have a heart-based feeling, heartfelt sense, I have a gut feeling, literally, that's telling me, wow, now I understand why people didn't like what I did. Now I understand how my sister is embarrassed by hearing about my escapades when I was there.
We're talking about feeling into the body as a way of cultivating compassion, that you're able to develop compassion for yourself and others, as the Buddha talked about.
Mindsight is the term I use for insight, which is understanding yourself and being in touch with your gut feelings and heartfelt sense. Empathy, which is literally understanding what her behavior was like for her sister or for you, her parents. And then what's called integration, where you say, I'm going to honor it with kindness and compassion what my sister went through. Now, part of that is you have to begin with compassion toward yourself. So as she develops these inner reflective skills, you may find she changes a lot. And this is why I felt that teenagers early on and adolescents later on, too, should be given these skills, because this would make all the difference.
There's a ton of research about self-compassion and its value. Dan, I want to see if we can squeeze one more call on.
Thank you, Dolores.
Thank you, Dolores. We've got Lisa on the line. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a very new challenge in my life, and I have a wonderful child who makes good decisions and good grades, and I feel close to, and I want in my heart to accept whoever this person is and wants to be, and I really want to do that, but my child recently told me that he is bisexual, and I think that I want to accept him. In my heart, I'm praying that he will change his mind and pick a woman, and I see this as a couple things: a barrier to any healthy relationship with anyone, scary to tell my younger sons, and what if he changes his mind later on and in life, and he's like has this following him.
Well, Lisa, I don't know if you heard our discussion with the previous caller, but you know, we talked about feeling into the body for the truth of our lives, and you said, I pray in my heart. And before you do anything in your head about accepting or not accepting or what's going to happen with this in the weeks and years and decades ahead, let's attend to your heart here. And, you know, like Dan talked about, self-compassion. What are you feeling? You said you're not able to accept right now. Okay. But what are you feeling in your heart? What are the emotions you truly feel? drop the storylines and just drop into yourself, your own experience, and hold that with compassion. And I don't know about you, Dan, but I would go there first.
Yeah, you know, Lisa, there's a literally an entire section of the Brainstorm book about exactly what you're going through. A young boy who came out to me as his therapist and to his parents saying that he was having sexual attraction toward, you know, people of the same gender, in this case, male. And the response of the parents was very much like you're describing for yourself. And you'll see in that part of the book the step-by-step approach I suggest to them to do exactly what Dan is saying, to search inside yourself to know what you're feeling, but also to the larger frame is this. You need to know what you're feeling as a starting place for sure. But for your son's experience, he really needs to be in a relationship with his parents who can just be tuned into who he is becoming and allowing him the space and the freedom to just explore whoever he's going to become. Because in people I've worked with over these many years, when they have parents who give them that space and that love and that attunement, just saying, listen, you're going to find out who you are, and I support you for it, then as they do that, they're actually happier, they're more connected with everyone in the world.
That's exactly what I want for children. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and I think that was a beautiful note to end on. It was instructive and helpful. Lisa, I sure hope that was helpful to you and to the rest of our listeners. Dan, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us. And you know, I also, on a personal note, I want to thank you for writing the foreword for my new book. You're just a good pal. We've been talking with Dr. Dan Siegel, and his book is called Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. Well, you can comment on today's show. We're at whyy.org/voices, and you can download our show there. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And check out my new webpage. I'm starting a blog there. It's on drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Gita Simons is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. I sure hope you enjoy your week, my friends.